I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Corey, welcome to the show for the first time. We're grateful to have you here because school choice is something we like to talk about, but we always like to get the expert opinion.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
So you are somebody who's made a living of advocating for school choice, and we've never seen more than now in a pandemic how much people are stuck in their own circumstances without an opportunity to improve upon them. Maybe it's based on zip code, maybe it's based on economics, while other people, if they are blessed with the means to be able to choose an alternative, it's really creating an additional disparity in the education of our kids. It seems like now more than ever, people should be waking up to the idea of school choice.
Absolutely, and they are. It's one thing for your children's public school to continue getting your children's education dollars even after failing them academically year after year, but it's another conversation altogether for that same school to continue to receive your children's education dollars regardless of whether they even open their doors for business, particularly when we're seeing that the private schools have been much more likely to reopen their doors for in-person instruction. And it's probably because they know that their customers can take their money elsewhere. And so I think families are changing how they view how we fund education. And I think they're starting to realize that there's no good reason to fund institutions, particularly closed institutions, when we can fund students directly instead, just like we do with so many other taxpayer initiatives. For example, with higher education, we fund students directly when it comes to the Pell Grant and the GI Bill for veterans. The funding goes to the student, and they can pick a public or private university, religious or non-religious university of their choosing. Same thing with pre-K programs, including the federal Head Start program. The money goes to the family, and you can choose a public provider if you want, but you can also choose a private religious or non-religious provider of pre-K services if you'd like. So I think families are starting to see that, look, we already do this with so many other things. Why not apply the same logic to K-12 education?
Corey DeAngelis is director of school choice at Reason Foundation. You mentioned money. There's been a lot of money spent on top of normal budgets for COVID relief throughout 2020, and now we've just passed another one. Have schools, in your opinion, been public schools, which have been closed, using that money appropriately, or has there been some mismanagement?
Well, it's not because of the money. It's not because of the safety, and it's not because of the money in the school reopening debate. And there have been four studies on this that have looked at the relationship between the power of the teachers' unions in the area and the likelihood of the schools reopening for in-person instruction. I know of these studies because I was the first one to do so, and it's now accepted for publication at Social Science Quarterly. My co-author from MIT, Christos Makrides, and I looked at the data and found that places with stronger teachers' unions were substantially less likely to reopen for in-person instruction, as have three other studies found. And what was really interesting in our data sets, we also found no consistent relationship between COVID risk in the area as measured by cases and deaths per capita and the reopening decisions of the schools. But on the contrary, we found that political partisanship in the area, the more blue your area was, for example, the schools were also less likely to reopen, all else equal, for in-person instruction. So it seems to be more about politics and power dynamics than about safety. And our latest study, which we talked about in the Wall Street Journal just last week, looking at over 12,000 school districts in the U.S., no matter how you slice the data, no matter what measure of funding you use per student or expenditures per student, or whether you take the log or the level of those outcomes or whatever controls you throw into the model, we found that spending or funding was not statistically related to the reopening of schools for public schools. But in some models, if anything, we found that the schools that had more money were actually less likely to reopen for in-person instruction than their in-person peers. So we're throwing billions of federal education dollars at these schools with no guarantee that the schools are going to be more likely to reopen. If you look at the latest stimulus package, it's $123 billion, which is nearly the amount that the U.S. dedicated to rebuild Europe after World War II in the Marshall Plan in real terms. And the Senate actually blocked an amendment by a senator by the name of Blunt, a 50-50 vote. Which would have made the amendment would have made the additional funding contingent upon the schools actually reopening for in-person instruction, given all of the teachers were vaccinated. Couldn't even do that. And so we're just throwing more money at the problem without solving the root issue, which I believe is the incentive structure that's set up in the system. The private schools have been fighting to open. The public school teachers unions have been fighting to remain closed. And the main difference is one of incentives. One of these systems, or sectors at least, gets your children's education dollars regardless of how well they do, regardless of the satisfaction of the families, and in the past year in particular, regardless of whether they even open their doors for business. And so I think this is why the latest Real Clear Opinion Research polling on this nationwide found that families are much more likely to support funding students as opposed to systems, a 10 percentage point jump from April to August of 2020 in support for these programs such as education savings accounts. And there's also been 29 states now as of today where legislators have introduced bills to fund students as opposed to institutions. And Missouri happens to be one of those states with two of these bills. And one of them is actually passed out of a chamber, House Bill, I want to say 349 in Missouri, passed out of the full House by a vote of 82-71 pretty recently.
Yeah, it is such an important subject for the people listening here with us on 97.1 FM Talk. We're speaking with Corey DeAngelis, who is the director of school choice at Reason Foundation and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Isn't it amazing that as we've talked about dollars and cents, lack of common sense, I would say, and the amount of money that we are throwing at this issue now as a nation, federal tax dollars, state tax dollars, local tax dollars. We've never thrown more money at this issue than we are right now. And we haven't even discussed, well, let's see, what are we getting for our money? Are our students overperforming now? The more we spend, the better our students are doing? Or is it the converse?
No, you can spend $100,000 per student and still get the same results if you don't change the incentive structure in the system, because you can just throw more money at the problem. And overall, what we've seen is as over time, we've put more and more money into the school system nationwide. We've increased per pupil education expenditures by 280% in real terms after adjusting for inflation since 1960. And each and every decade, we've increased per pupil education expenditures in real terms without meaningful increases in academic outcomes. So we're just throwing more money at the problem, and that's not an adequate solution if the problem isn't resources and it's more likely to be rooted in incentives. And what really points this out pretty clearly is the nationwide data finding that over time, between 1992 and 2014, inflation-adjusted per-pupil education expenditures in public schools increased by 27%, but real teacher salaries actually dropped by 2%. So we're throwing more money into the system, and it's going towards administrative bloat and staffing surges, which is great for teachers' unions because it allows for a larger political voting bloc with more members, and it allows for more dues from having more members, which is great for union bosses, but not great for the individual teachers in the system, because those dollars aren't being allocated to the classroom. And in fact, if you look at all five studies on the topic that I've seen, when charter schools or private schools are in the area and there's more competition, the public schools start to pay their teachers better in response to that competition. They start to scratch their heads a little bit and start to think about, well, maybe I should allocate more of the resources to the classroom instead of on an administrative bloat. And so school choice actually benefits teachers, too, from those competitive pressures for their employers to spend the money wisely in the classroom.
So let's talk practically, Corey. How do we implement something like school choice, where the kids ultimately are the winners here? The education that they receive is increased, and they're benefited from that, along with the tax dollars that are being collected, so that we can still pay good teachers well, and have that competition.
Yeah, the best way to do it is something called an education savings account or education scholarship account, whichever you'd like to call it. But the funding that would have followed the child to the traditional public school would follow them to wherever they're getting an education. That could be the traditional public school. That option would still be on the table. But if not, for whatever reason, they would be able to take a fraction of their dollars. Sometimes it depends on the bill, but typically it's about half, would follow the child to a private school to pay for tuition and fees, or they could use the money to cover the cost of home-based education. They could even use these funds for special needs therapies if you have a special needs child, or even micro schools, or what people are calling pandemic pods this year, where 5 to 10 children are getting together in a household so families can economize on the cost of home-based education. And so these education savings accounts would follow the child to any of these private providers of education services. And it really gets us from the ESA in particular, really gets us from school choice to education choice, because it follows you to the child to wherever they're getting an education. And it's not just a private school. It could be in another setting. And what's great about this is that it builds in a benefit for the public schools too. I mentioned that only about half of the funding follows the child to wherever they're getting an education. The other half, or a significant portion of the funding, stays with the traditional public school, which means on a per pupil basis, they actually end up with more per pupil revenues each year. Because mathematically, you lose the student, you get to keep some of the funding, you'll have higher per pupil revenues. And so when the defenders of the status quo try to say that these programs are stealing money from the public schools or taking away money from the public schools, my first response is, well, the money doesn't belong to the public schools. It doesn't belong to the private schools either. It belongs to the families. They should be able to determine where the funding goes. No one says that food stamp programs steal money from Walmart just because families can take the money to Trader Joe's. No one says that Pell Grants steal money from community colleges just because you can use the Pell Grant funding at a private provider of higher education services. No one says that the Head Start Pre-K program steals money from the public provider just because you can take the funding to a private provider of pre-K services. What's interesting is that all this pushback is only talked about when we come to K-12 education. A lot of the same people who support funding students directly at all these, in all these other programs, they get all up in arms when it comes to K-12 education. And the only difference is one of power dynamics. Choice is the norm when it comes to higher education, pre-K, and groceries, and any other service in the economy. But choice threatens an entrenched special interest that gets your children's education dollars regardless of how well they do, and this year in particular, regardless of whether they even open their doors for business. So they fight really hard against any change to the status quo, even if their institutions financially benefit on a per-pupil basis. Because they want to keep 100% of the funding. They don't want to just keep 50% or 40% or whatever it turns out to be.
Yeah, you've illustrated in such a perfect way here where the power structure is, where the money goes. And, you know, just ultimately speaking here, what's the best thing to educate our children and our future? And it is school choice. I want to encourage people to follow you on Twitter at DeAngelis Corey, and continue to see your efforts on this, because this is something specifically in Missouri. We have some form of incentives in the state of Illinois. But it needs to grow, it needs to expand, and it needs to be done for our kids. And Corey, we appreciate you coming on the show today to talk about what you've been doing to try to help encourage people to see how this can happen.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.